Welcome, everybody. Our topic for tonight is managing the Pesach diet for those with food sensitivity and allergies. First of all, the genesis of this year is that I, myself, was gluten sensitive, I guess we could say. May still be, but I'm not as stringent with myself. And I was very cognizant of the challenge that Pesach, sometimes poses for those who have unique dietary restrictions. And in general, I want to talk about having a healthy Pesach. There was an article written a few years back in the Jewish Action by Reuven Spolter, and he writes that about a decade ago, this is him referring to himself, he went into the doctor for a checkup, and the doctor says to him that if you don't lose weight, you're going to be type 2 diabetes. And the doctor, who was a secular Jew, added, "You Orthodox eat too much." And Spolter writes, "Why is he picking on us?" But then on further reflection, he realized that the doctor was absolutely right. Consider a typical Shabbos. Friday night, we begin with a meal. Wine, challah, appetizer, soup, main course, dessert. Then maybe a shalom zachar. Then in the morning, we have have a piece of cake and coffee. And then you go to shul. Depending on your practice, you may have a kiddush. You may come home and then eat another meal. Then there's shalosh shudis. And right by the time we finish a Shabbos, it may not be the most healthy thing. So beyond what I think Spolter points out about Shabbos, I think that Pesach actually provides a challenge that most of us, I guess, assume that this is just the way we have to do things, right? We consume an absurd amount of matzah, and no good kosher Pesach item could go without the staple that what they had in the olden days, in the days of, right, cottonseed oil, of course, right? That's what they had in the shtetl, right? No, obviously, right. Potatoes, right? So potatoes, right? But so a lot of what I want to do tonight is, I don't think it's not just for those with food allergies. It's also for hopefully a general perspective on the value within Judaism of being healthy. And surprisingly, radical as it may sound, I think that being healthy is a value in Judaism. And I want to show you a few proof texts for this and a few concepts. So first of all, for those who join, we have a bar mitzvah going on in the shul at the same time. So if you hear some music, nobody's playing in our room, but it's, we're very excited that things are back and happening in the shul. So I apologize for the background noise. But we're now on the first source here. I broke it up into two parts. This first part is about the, I'll share my screen so everyone can see the sources. This is about just the general concept of staying healthy on in Judaism. So the first source I have over here is a pasuk in Devarim. It says, "V'nishmartim me'od l'nafshoseichem." You should be very, very careful with your lives. And we have another pasuk, "Hishamer l'cha," source number two, "Ushmor nafshecha me'od." Be very careful. Again, this language of being, extremely careful. So we have biblical support for being careful with your life, which the all the way down from the Torah, the Gemara, the Poskim, all interpret this to mean physically careful, careful with the physical well-being of your body. And we also have a halachic principle of chamira sakanta misura, that the dangers to your physical health are actually more serious. They're more chamur, they're more stringent. We should look at them in a more, we should be more careful than actual forbidden things, isura, like a treif, right? People think, well, having an extra piece of kugel, like, that's okay, I'm not making any judgments here. But obviously I'm not going to eat treif. I mean, I'm obviously going to have the highest level of kashrus. We're going to see that the value of keeping oneself, oneself healthy is certainly a very, very important matter. In fact, even more important than some actual prohibitions on the books and actual treif. Now, if you look at the fourth source, that Gemara, the Gemara in Chulin, source number three, the Gemara in Chulin quotes that principle at the end over there. I won't go into the details because we have a lot to cover. We want to cover a lot for tonight to prepare everyone for the practical side of this, not just the hashkafa, the perspective. So the fourth source, the Rambam says in Hilchos Deos, the Rambam writes, Maimonides writes, Hol v'hayos, sorry, and then he continues and says you have to be careful and treat your body and get the right amount of sleep and eat the right things. But he says, since the line that I want to focus on, the underlying piece is, since maintaining a healthy and sound body is among the ways of God. Stop. That is a principle that is clearly in the sources, that it is important to treat your body with respect, both on the spiritual level, which we all kind of assume, like that's what kosher is, right? We want to, you know, follow what Hashem asks of us and only consume the things that are permitted. But the Rambam's telling us that keeping a healthy body, maintaining a healthy and sound body is a way among the ways of God. Now, what if people ask, well, I thought there's a concept called Shomer Mitzvah Lo Yoda Davara, the Pasuk in Kohelet says. If someone's following the Torah, someone's following the mitzvot, they will not, nothing bad will happen to them. Right? And they say the Neshama Yisera on Shabbos, you have an extra Neshama, you could eat more, it's okay, don't worry. It's not, you're not going to gain weight on Shabbos, all these phrases that people throw out. So, I actually want to treat this with a little bit of seriousness, with all the jokes aside, and then we'll move on to the particulars of the Pesach Seder. But in general, is one, if one's doing a mitzvah, let's say you're eating matzah, which is a mitzvah, but we'll see. We'll talk about people who are celiac, people who are very, very allergic to matzah. So let's say a person will say, well, if the Torah is asking me to do something, I have to do it. And even if I'm going to have to go to the hospital, even if I'm going to be sick. So is that the proper approach to mitzvahs? So the Oneg Yontif, which is Rav Yontif Lipman Halperin, he writes in his work in the Shut, the Shailish Shuvas Oneg Yontif Simin Mem Aleph, this is in the fifth source, he talks about a concept where there were a few baby boys that unfortunately were having, were getting circumcised, having a bris, and they were not, the blood was not stopping. Either they were hemophiliac or something along those lines. And that's what it is, right? When people can't, the blood doesn't clot, right? Hemophiliac, right? So, and then there comes the second son, and the child also passes away, unfortunately. And the case may not have happened, but the Gemara is discussing, you know, the principle. And the Gemara says that the Gemara in Yevamos, that you should not give a bris milah to the third child, because we already saw two of them were not able to survive. This third child, we don't give a bris milah to. And Rav Halperin says, based on this principle, the way he understands from this Gemara, is that if there's a sakana because of a mitzvah, he adds another point, if it's Shabbos, generally we do a bris milah on Shabbos. We don't say it's a chil Shabbos because we have a mitzvah saseh, and the Torah said that you do it on the eighth day, and the eighth day is even when the Gemara learns out, even when it falls out on Shabbos. But in a case where there's a sakana, he says, number one, you shouldn't do it if it's dangerous for the baby, and number two, if you were to do it on Shabbos, you would be in violation of Shabbos because it's not a mitzvah. Hashem does not want you to give this boy a bris milah because it's dangerous for him. And picking up on that, in the sixth source of Sternbach in Shuvas V'Hanhagos, he quotes this Oneg Yontif, and he distinguishes between two kinds of risks. One risk, he says, I'll just tell you in the underlying piece, he says, Nir l'chalek she'im harofim kovim shebevanei o al pirov yazik. That perhaps we can distinguish between, if doctors, they define, and they say that generally speaking, for either it's a certainty or it's a majority, that this particular act will be dangerous for you. Eino mitzvah klal. Certainly not a mitzvah. However, he says, perhaps if generally al pi rov, majority's time of the time, it won't be dangerous, then, and only rak harofim machmir sheish is a chashash, but the doctor is concerned, there's a level of risk, you know, under rov it could be 49%. 49% is still a high level of risk from a medical perspective, at least in today's modern medical numbers. And he says, in that case, although he says it's proper not to do it, not to do the mitzvah, one, and certainly not obligated to do the mitzvah if they will experience a, you know, this risk, or they will be chancing this risk. He says, mikol mokom, if you want, you could be machmir, eino over, you're not in violation of these principles of nishmartem es nafshoseichem. And he says, this principle, the shomer mitzvah lo yada davar ra, that because if one does a mitzvah, you're not going to know anything evil, nothing bad can happen to you. And he says, we found many tzaddikim, many righteous people who were moser nefesh. We have a Gemara, Rabbi Akiva was moser nefesh. He gave up his life to do a mitzvah, and that is a principle. But he goes back and says again, this is only for tzaddikim, for people who are really, really special. And even that, he's like almost like, you know, in a pinch, he's saying, okay, you want to do it, fine. But really, it's not appropriate for most of us. And that's only when it's not a significant risk. If it were to be a significant risk, then even someone who wants to be very frum should not even do it. Absolutely is obligated not to do it. There are stories that I've heard from rabbis in communities in which they have elderly people still. This is going back years, but I remember one of our rabbeim teaching us in YU in the REITS program, the Smicha program, that he had elderly people in his community who were Holocaust survivors. And the doctors told them, you cannot fast on Yom Kippur. So Erev Yom Kippur, or I guess maybe it was a few days before Yom Kippur, this rabbi, I remember him telling us, I don't remember who it was, but I remember him telling us, he said, I would have to go around and explain to these people. I understand. And he said it broke his heart because it was so hard to hear from the rabbi, you have to eat on Yom Kippur. And no, rabbi, I'm not doing it. And the rabbi would say, please, please, you have to eat. And it was back and forth. And for every single situation, we have to look at it from, what does Hashem want from us in this situation? Maybe we're going to be keeping Yom Kippur. We're not talking about Yom Kippur, but in that case, Yom Kippur will be different for some people than for others. But it's not about what we think we should be doing. It's about, what does Hashem want from me in my particular situation? And Hashem knows what everyone's individual story is. And therefore, we have to know that when we ask our Rav, we learn the topic, we ask a question, we may not be doing everything the way that other people are doing it, and that's 100% fine, because everybody's different and everyone's circumstance is different. So based on those sources, I think it is fair to say that we can do it. We can have a healthy Pesach, keeping our siddurim, keeping on the one hand, our spiritual obligations, but also recognizing and respecting our physical bodies and not treating them poorly. I'll just finish off one more story or mashal, I would say, for this introduction section. So there's a well-known mashal of the Dubna Magid. The Dubna Magid, Rav Yaakov Cranes, was well-known for his ability to describe values in a parable. And he tells the following story, which I think just it drives home this point very clearly. That there was once a merchant who was arriving home from work. And he had a helper, a porter, you know, depending on which country it was in. I guess he's talking probably in Dubna is in Poland, I guess. I don't know. I apologize for my ignorance of geography. It's definitely not in North America. And so they had a helper bringing it with his things in a wagon, and the merchant opens the door after this porter is, you know, schlepping his bag with him, and he takes one look at the bag and he says, "That's not my bag." And the porter says, "You didn't even look inside of it. How do you know that this is not your bag?" He says, "Because I know if it's not my bag, it can't be my bag." He says, "Well, why not?" He says, "I see you're sweating, you're schwitzing, you're dragging it across the floor. My bag had a few diamonds in it. It didn't have rocks. It didn't have lumber, right?" The same is true when it comes to Judaism. The Dubna Magid said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu looks at you and he sees how you're practicing Judaism. And if it feels like a schlep, if it feels like a pain and it feels hard, that's not what Hashem wants from us. And obviously, that doesn't mean that we don't have, you know, levels of sacrifice that we're willing to make. But it shouldn't feel like so heavy and so and we're schwitzing and it's awful and we can't stand it and it makes us resentful. There's probably something, either we misunderstood or we have to adjust, because although there may be stringencies and people say, oh, it's a good thing to do this, it's a good thing to do that, if it's going to come at the expense of you know, feeling resentful. That's certainly not what we want, and it's certainly not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to feel from Yontif. Okay. I think we are ready to tackle what we're going to discuss tonight in specific Seder practices. So I want to cover five things tonight. I want to cover matzah. Included in matzah is how much you have to eat, as well as gluten-free matzah. I want to cover the second part, the four cups of wine, the dalakosas, how much, grape juice, dilution. I want to talk about, that's to be in part three. And the fourth part is dilution. And the fifth part are quick, briefly on kitnios and legumes. Okay, so we're ready to dive into part number one. I will scroll down over here. Part number one, how much matzah does one really need to eat? How much really, right? So we see these charts and we see these numbers and it looks like, you have to, basically consume an entire box per person, and it just is. So I'll first tell you at the outset, I'm going to present to you what the ideal is. And when I say ideal, I mean without any other circumstances. Then we're going to start cutting it down and understanding what we really need to eat. And this is before we're discussing anyone who has a wheat allergy, anyone who has a gluten allergy. This is just someone who it's difficult to eat a lot of matzah. So let's understand how much we really need to eat. So there are three times in the Seder that we actually generally eat matzah, right? We have motzi matzah, right? When we're starving, we're ready to eat. Okay, finally motzi matzah. Korech, which is the sandwich. And safun, which is afikomen. So those are three times that we eat matzah. Now, the Shulchan Aruch writes that ideally one should have two kizesim, two olive sizes, which we're going to discuss at length what an olive size is, but two kizesim for motzi matzah, because the rationale is that one kizai is from the broken piece of matzah and one kizai is from the whole piece of matzah. The reason is because one of them is to be broken for lechem oni. We want, right? So you're getting... you're having the Bala Seder, the person who's leading the Seder is doing the Lecha Mishnah, he has two, and then one's going to be broken. And you have a Kezias from the broken and a Kezias from the whole. Now, that's ideally two, but if that's not enough to go around, Rosh Shlomo Zalman says that you just have a little piece of the broken one. So anyways, we've said, okay, ideally two, but let's be honest, if you have many people at your Seder, you're not going to all be able to have from that broken piece. So even there, Rav Shlomo Zalman says, so you have a little piece of the broken, but it doesn't have to be a full kezias. Okay. Number two time we have to eat is the korech. The Shulchan Aruch writes, the Mishneh Berurah, not going through everything inside, we have a lot to cover, but he says one kezias is enough for korech. So now we've said, okay, three kezesim and really probably only two and a little bit. That's what we have so far. And then when it comes to afikomen, the Shulchan Aruch rules that one should eat one kezias. And there are others, Darkei Moshe, Mariel says it's preferable to have two kezesim. So max, max, max. Let's just go through the max and then we'll start cutting it down. The maximum that you would have to have, according to the Mahajim and a Mahajrin, is five kezesim, because you have two for the first motzi matzah, you have one for korech, then you have two more for the afikoman. Before we get to how much is that, because by the way, it's not that much. An olive size we're going to talk about is really an olive size. Before we get to that, what would be the bare minimum? So we've already discussed that even for the first one, we said you could have one kezias for motzi matzah and a little bit of the broken. We also have that the Shulchan Aruch says you only really need one for afikomen. You don't really need two if it's difficult. You'd only at that point need three. For one for korek, one for motzi matzah, one for afikomen. Let's say somebody it's very, very difficult for them to have even this amount of matzah. So what do they do? So there's a Magen Avraham, source number two. The Magen Avraham, one of the commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, writes that a person who is ill, who cannot have any more than one kezias, what should he do? So he should eat his meal. They should eat their meal, and then not eat any motzi matzah. And then the last thing they should eat is afikomen. And what do? They eat one kezias of the afikomen. And that's the last thing that they eat. And they're able to get, they're not going to do korech, because it's important, but not for someone who can't eat more than one. You have a mitzvah, a biblical mitzvah to do one kezias, and you're getting everything in that one kezias. You're getting your motzi matzah, you're getting your afikomen, and he says you should be mevarech hamotzi. You should say the bracha of hamotzi. Then you say al achilas matzah, and then you eat one kizayis. And the Rav Asher Weiss paskins this halacha lemaisa that if somebody is very difficult for them to have, you know, many kizayis, and they have one kizayis. So now that's what the minimum shear would be, and then we'll discuss even someone who can't even have that. So how much is a kizayis, right? We've discussed maybe there's five, you have to have five, maybe you have to have one. What is a kizayis? So there's two basic shiurim. You may have heard of this before, the dispute between Rav Chaim Na and the Chazon Ish. Rav Chaim Na, he measured that the amount of a kizayis is 86 cubic centimeters. 86 cubic centimeters is not very large. It's about the size of a credit card. Pretty much the size. I didn't actually measure it, but that's what I was told. Rav Ron Yitzchak Eisenman gave us that shear. So we have this, about this size is a kizayis. Because you're rounding up the matzah and you're putting it into an avzayis, that's as much. So this amount of matzah would be for one kizayis. And then if you're going to have five, so it's about half a matzah of shmura matzah. It's about half, probably a little even less, but fine. Rav Chazon Ish doubled the size. Why did he double the size? And this is going to have many ramifications on all the different shiurim, because without going into all the details, there's a concern that the olives that we have today are not as large as they used to be, and because of that, they double the size. We're not going to go with the Chazon Ish. I don't think anybody, anyone who's trying to be Mahadran and go and you know, great, wonderful, no one's going to begrudge you for that. But right now we're dealing with what is the, if it's difficult for someone to eat. So we're certainly not going to go with the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish, just so that you should know, he holds it's about 150 cubic centimeters. But again, that's two credit cards. So two credit cards per kizayis. And Rav Mordechai Willig, who is someone who I was in touch with in preparing this shiur, he holds that you can follow Rav Chaim Na. It's totally 100% fine. And we'll see, he has a very small shiur for a kizayis. He actually believes it's only about 45 cubic centimeters. I'm sorry, he holds it's only about 22.5 cubic centimeters. He says for hand matzah, you're going to be shocked for this, Rav Mordechai Willig holds that for hand matzah, it's about one-fifth of a hand matzah. So maybe that is about a credit card size. Yeah, I guess so. I guess Rav Chaim Na is a little bit larger. So that's what I have in my mind, the credit card from Rabbi Eisenman. So Rabbi Willig holds, to go back, that it's about 22.5 cubic centimeters. But what you have to know is credit card. That's just the way that I remember it, and that's the way. Credit card is enough. It's a little bit, probably even a little bit larger. The credit card is a little bit larger, but that is the minimum amount. So a person who, let's review. A person should have ideally about 4 to 5 kizayisim of matzah. If they can't have that, which is about, as we mentioned, about half of a average hand-sized piece of matzah, probably about 2/3 or 2/5. Probably, it depends on how big it is, but I would imagine around 2/5 of machine matzah and about 1/5 of hand matzah. So if you're having 4 or 5 kizayisim, that's about 1 hand matzah. If that's too much, we said you could cut it down to 4, you could cut it down to 3. If you could only have 1, what you should do, practically speaking, is you should wait till after Shulchan Orech. Don't make any hamotzi. Eat the, make the brachas on your food. Then make, wash, then say hamotzi, then make an al achilas matzah, and then you're eating your one piece of your credit card of matzah as your afikomen and your motzi matzah all in one. Okay. So I think we could breathe, right? That's a sigh of relief. It's not, it may not be the same what other people are doing, but that is 100%. You have Rabbi Mordechai Willig's haskama. You have his approbation. You can only need to eat minimally one credit card piece of matzah. Now, what if a person is celiac or is deathly allergic to any sort of wheat, and they cannot have even a credit card? They can't have. So by the way, I researched this a little bit when I was gluten-free. Spelt does have gluten in it. Some people don't know this. Spelt does have gluten in it. It just has a little bit less than wheat. The only option you really have, if you're celiac or if you're highly allergic to wheat for whatever reason, is oat matzah. Now, oats is one of the chamishas minei dagan. Maybe. We'll discuss this now. There are five types of grain. And these five types of grain, the Mishnah Pesachim writes, I guess we went back to source number one. I'm sorry, I apologize for that. My numbers went backwards. But I think we all have the same numbers, so it's okay. So the Mishnah Pesachim discusses the five types of grain that you're allowed to make matzahs with. And we discussed wheat, chitin, seorin is barley, kusmin is spelt, and shifon is rye, and shiboles shu'al. We're not going to translate that word right now. But as you may have guessed, it may be oats. So the Mishnah says shiboles shu'al. What is shiboles shu'al? So there has been a general dispute as to what this word is, and we'll see about three different opinions on it in a moment. But even before we get to that, the Rabbi David Cohen, one of the poskim for the CRC, he has a whole article called Celiac, A Guide to Mitzvah Observance, and it's a guide for Pesach. And he writes that some grains, some say there's a reason to actually use wheat and not other grains, even though the Mishnah clearly says that you can use other wheats, other grains, because some of the poskim wrote that the reason for this practice was that we're worried that you're not going to know how to use it, it's going to come to chametz. We know that there's a very quick process that you have to utilize for making matzah, and you basically mix the water with the flour, and you have to do it quickly and bake it, and we're worried if you don't use wheat, the other types of grains are going to create chametz, and you're not going to know how to prevent them from making chametz. However, he also records here that based on the way that Rabbi Kestenbaum, who was the first to really, in the 80s really, this is all pretty new, in the 80s he promulgated the oat matzah, and he was able to figure out exactly what the cutoff point was between chametz and not, and that was told to Rav Dayan Weiss, the Minchas Yitzchak, and he was okay with it if somebody was celiac or allergic, that he would allow people to eat oat matzah. And you can definitely find oat matzah out there. I hope that it's in Toronto. I haven't seen it. It's really expensive. You might as well go bankrupt, but in Blechemoni, right? The poor man's bread. But it is there. I'll scroll down just so you can see that source there, Rabbi David Cohen. But there are some, and Rabbanim give hechsherim to this, and I'm not questioning their hechsherim, and there's certainly well-established poskim that rely on this. However, I just want to raise a couple of issues with you, and then we'll move on, because practically speaking, if someone is allergic, we'll talk about they should eat oat matzah. But I just want to raise some of the issues if somebody is gluten sensitive, like myself. I wasn't allergic to gluten, but I actually was encouraged by Rabbi Willig to have some wheat or some spelt for my matzah for the following reasons. And I want to explain now why. So, although there is someone who is allergic, certainly should have oat, and we'll see why that is. There are some obstacles to defining oat matzah as kosher matzah for Pesach. It's certainly not chametz, but it may not be the ideal way to fulfill the mitzvah of matzah. So, number one, there's an issue of matzah having to be able to become chametz. Some have tested oats, and they, unlike Rabbi Kestenbaum, we were saying before, he made sure it doesn't become chametz, but some people tested it and they found that it can never become chametz. And the Gemara in Pesachim, source number 3, writes that the definition of the chamishas minei dagan, the things that can work for chametz, for matzah, are things that you would be able to become chametz. So wheat could become chametz, but you just don't let it rise, and that's matzah. Other things that some people want to claim will be like, for example, why can't we use rice besides for the problem with kinyos? But before kinyos were a thing, right? Why can't we use rice or millet for matzah? The answer is because it doesn't ferment. It doesn't create a fermentation process. So some, it doesn't decay, it doesn't become what they call in the Gemara, lidei sirchon. It's not button lidei sirchon. It doesn't ferment. And therefore, some want to argue that because oats don't ferment, they can't become chametz, they would be unacceptable for the Seder. Now, this really, as I mentioned to you, is a debate, and there are many poskim that say it's fine, but you should just realize that there are those that would say better to use other types of grain. Now we have a question even if we want to say that it could become chametz, and even if we want to say that we're not going to, you know, that we're going to ignore those other poskim that say that it has to, that there's an issue because it has to become chametz, there is a different issue, which is what I alluded to before, that the word shiboles shual is disputed. What does the word mean? So the reason why we assume that it's oats is because this is what Rashi says. If you look at source number 5, Rashi translates shiboles shual as avino. Avino is oats, and that's what the Rabbeinu Gershom says as well in source number 6. However, the Rambam in Perasha Mishnayis, he says shiboles shual is the seora hamidbaris, the field barley. Field barley, as we'll see in a moment, is certainly not oats. And the Sefer HaAruch, Rav Nassan of Rome, he actually writes, and you can see a little picture there where he shows the different, what it looks like and different things. And he actually says that Shiboles Shu'al is rye. That's what the Aruch says, it's rye. Now, we have a three-way dispute over here. Who's right? Who's right? So, there was an interesting sefer put out in the 60s by Professor Yehuda Felix, and this sefer was called Tzomeach V'Hachai B'Mishnah. You see source number 9. He argued that Rashi, although he says explicitly that it was oats, that Shiboles Shu'al were oats, but he says it's likely that in France they had oats, but in Eretz Yisrael in ancient times they did not have oats. And he wants to argue that the Rambam is correct. The Rambam is correct that in fact Shiboles Shu'al really is more likely a form of barley. Now, if you look, I got a picture from the internet over here. Before, go look, turn back a page, where you see there's like this black background with the two stalks over here. So if you look, it says 2R and 6R. So 2R over here is probably what we would call seora, or barley, but the 2R stands for two road barley. If you look at the, it almost looks like the hadassim on Sukkot. You see, like each of the sections of the grain has these two rows of the grain. However, there's something called field barley, or otherwise known as six road barley, where there is actually six little kernels there, and that is probably what the Rambam is referring to when he calls Shiboles Shu'al the seora midbaris, the field barley. In fact, the Professor Felix has a bunch of proofs to this point. I'm not going to go into it. We have a lot to cover. But Professor Felix notes a couple of perushim that actually say that what does the word Shiboles Shu'al mean? It means the grain of the tail of a fox. Shu'al is a fox. And if you look at the way that the six-road barley looks, it actually looks like the tail of a fox. Whereas if you look at the way that oats grow, I didn't know what it looked like until I saw the aruch, the pictures in the aruch there, but it has these little, if you look at in the bottom left of the, I'll tell you which page it's on in the packet, the bottom left over here online, you could see it's this, almost like these welting little pieces. If you look at, I don't actually know which page it's on for you, but it's source number 8. Source number 8 in the bottom left, that's what he calls the oats over there. And it doesn't look at anything like the tail of a fox. However, they once showed this Professor Felix's sefer, who was actually a from Israeli botanist, and he came out with this sefer challenging the age-old assumption that we always thought that oats is one of the five grains. And they showed this. This is recorded in Rav Hershel Schechter's sefer called Mipnini HaRav about Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Joseph B. Soloveitchik, and they showed Rav Soloveitchik this sefer. And you know what he did with this sefer? He threw it on the table. He said, "We don't decide halacha based on science," which it's interesting because we don't always say this, but he says, we have a mesorah, we have a tradition. You're challenging thousands of years of tradition that we assume that oats is one of the five grains. And he was very upset by this sefer. It's just a fascinating note that Rav Schechter himself, a Talmud, a student of Rav Soloveitchik, seemingly disagrees with this point and utilizes science in he's in different areas of halacha. I won't go into all the details, but even within it comes to oats, he has a whole interesting opinion about oats and and these energy bars and different things. And Rav Schechter is, you know, may doubt the efficacy, the validity of arguing that oats are one of the five grains. But that is not really our topic. But suffice to say, that is a hurdle that an obstacle that you have to overcome. However, if this is, I would just I'll bottom line this point for you, because there's a lot to discuss and I want to go on to the four cups. Bottom line, if a person cannot have any wheat, they are severely allergic to any gluten. So, besides the price, like Aliza said, they would be advised to use oat matzah. However, if someone is just gluten sensitive, like I was, so when I asked Rabbi Willig, can I use oat matzah to be yotzei my mitzvah? He said, it's not pashut, it's not simple. And I said, well, should I or should I not? It's not simple. Like, he didn't want to, encourage me to use it. And he asked me, are you really allergic? And I said, I'm not really, I'm trying it out. I was doing it as sort of a test. And at the end of the day, that is what I did. Throughout Pesach, I didn't have that much wheat. But just for the Seder, I tried to have a kezias of wheat. I actually think I had more than a kezias of wheat, and I was fine. But let's say someone cannot have that. So practically speaking, the poskim say that at the Seder, oat matzah will be fine. Some note that it's preferable to listen to someone else make the bracha of al achilas matzah. I don't know if you have to go that far. At the end of the day, that's what you're eating, and you have what to rely on. And that is 100% legitimate for somebody who cannot have anything else. Okay. Any questions about matzah, shiurim, and sizes? Okay. The four cups of wine. Okay. So, first of all, I call them the four cups of wine. But do you really need to drink wine? So, let's say somebody has a sulfite allergy. Most wines have sulfite in them. Let's say someone has issues with alcohol. Let's say someone's diabetic. So, the Gemara Nedarim, source number 15, writes that there were these Rabbi Yehuda, and it just says a certain Gentile woman actually said to Rabbi Yehuda she just says to him that how could you teach and be drunk at the same time, seemingly as a sort of a disrespectful thing to say to him. But one thing that the Gemara says after that is that that Rabbi Yehuda responds and he says that really after I drink wine I'm actually very, very sick. The Gemara calls this chorganitzi idoi min haPesach ad atzeres, because after I drink the four cups of wine on Pesach I have to gird myself. They say over here tie my temples. I don't know if that's simple explanation. At the end of the day, it was either a stomach ache or a headache from Pesach until Shavuot. So he was very, very sick. So based on this Gemara, you might think that you have to drink the four cups of wine, even if you'll be sick, very, very sick. However, it's not so simple. The Shulchan Aruch does say one should push themselves, even if they don't like wine. The Mishnah Berurah writes, okay, how much do you have to push yourself? The Mishnah Berurah writes that if it would make one sick and have to make them go to bed, or it would be dangerous for their health, then they're actually patur, they're actually exempted from drinking the four cups of wine. Now, the question is, it's hard for me to drink wine, but let's say I could drink grape juice. So what about grape juice? Is that considered okay for the Seder? Many people have grape juice for Kiddush on Shabbos. Is that the same halacha when it comes to the Seder? So while you do have opinions that say that one should not use grape juice for the Seder, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that doesn't give the same level of chayrus, the same level of freedom. But we're discussing someone who either they cannot have it, it would be dangerous for them to have it, and they can't drink wine. So certainly, Rav Mordechai Willick said they should drink grape juice. In fact, Rav Soloveitchik writes And I have this quoted in source number 17. Again, a citation of Rav Soloveitchik in one of Rav Hershel Schachter's works in Nefesh HaRav. He writes, based on the Rambam there, he writes that if one prefers grape juice for whatever reason, and it's better to drink grape juice than to drink wine. This is based on the Rambam in source number 16. The Rambam writes, Hakol lefi ayayin or lefi das hashoseh. Everything depends on the preferences of the person drinking it. The wine and the person's preferences. And the counter argument, maybe one would say, well, what do you mean? The Gemara said that he would gird his loins, he would I'm saying gird his loins, it said here that it would hold his head, but either way, he was so sick after drinking four cups of wine and he still did it. So how could you tell me that you could just drink grape juice? Or if Soloveitchik is purported to have said, or by Willard told me, he said that that was because they didn't have grape juice back then. They didn't have an alternative. That was the only thing they had. So now that we have this alternative, you should certainly utilize it if you need to. So how much do you have to drink? So now that we've said better to drink wine, some actually people who are diabetic, actually dry wine is better for them because it has less sugar content. But someone who has, let's say, a sulfite allergy or someone who has an issue with alcohol, so certainly should drink grape juice. So grape juice is fine. Wine, you know, if we're not dealing with allergies, we're not dealing with anything else, wine would be preferable because you get more opinions that are in favor of that. But again, Rabbi Willig encourages people to drink grape juice if they need to, or even if they prefer it, as we saw from Rav Soloveitchik. However, how much do you need to drink? So the Gemara Pesachim in source number 18 says, Kedei Revius. How much is a Revius? So, and this is what the Shulchan Aruch paskins in source number 19, the shear of one of your cups, one cup is a Revius. So, by the way, if you want specific numbers and an entire printout, I can share with you. I can share with you via email. I can give it to you myself. I just didn't want to hand you so many papers, even though I did give you a lot of papers. But there is a very wide range in how much a revius is, as you can imagine. We have everything from, I'll discuss in a moment, the smallest shear, but the largest shear, as we mentioned, according to the Chazon Ish. Okay, 1 second. We're going to just ask some people to be a little quieter. We'll continue in a second. Thank you, Eliza. So we have, as we mentioned, the Chazon Ish is going to be the largest shear, the largest amount, and that's 5.1 ounces, fluid ounces, per cup, that's a lot. That is a lot. And you have everything from that to all the way, Rabbi Mordechai Willig holds 2.5 ounces is a revius. 2.5 ounces is pretty much a double shot glass, I think, is close to that. A double shot glass, which is not the little small plastic ones, but sort of the bigger glass shot glasses, that's 2.5 ounces. Now, you don't need to drink the entire cup. Obviously, it's very nice to do that. If we're discussing someone who has difficulty drinking this, one does not need to drink the entire cup. One does need to drink Rove Kos, the majority of the cup. So now, let's do a little bit of math. I'm very, very bad at math, but if all you need is 2.5 ounces, if you're going to go with Rabbi Willig's shear, which this is what I think, this is my Rebbe, and this is what I, 100% give my approval. What's my approval? We have Rabbi Mordechai Willig on your side. But either way, this is certainly fine. Other organizations, which I have in the source number 20, the Star K has a Pesach guide. They hold, I think, 3.8 fluid ounces. And they have a whole dilution chart over here, which I brought for you because I think it's just helpful to know. But so they're a little bit larger. But, under 4 is not a lot we're talking about. Over here, 4 fluid ounces, and all you need is the majority. So let's do a little bit of math on the minimum shear with Rabbi Willig, and you can apply it as you see fit. If you can go a little bit larger, but let's apply it according to Rabbi Willig's shear. So if you only need the majority of the cup, So that means that for every cup, you have four cups. For every cup, all you need is basically 1 1/3 ounces. So basically, 1 1/3 times four, how much is that? Four and... I'm very bad at math, but it's about... about 5 ounces. About 5 ounces. So 5 ounces of either wine or of grape juice is really not that much. It's really not that much. What Rabbi Willick said, it's GMG, garnishment garnished, which it means nothing from nothing. It's very, very little. And I will now add another leniency to the mix. No pun intended. One, you can mix your wine with grape juice. You can mix your grape juice with water. Or you can mix your wine with water. Now, you have to be careful about this, because if you mix it so much, dilute it so much with water, you will lose the status of wine. So I have here for you the Star K, which is basically run by Rav Moshe Heineman and Co. in Baltimore. He holds, I think that he says over here, it's that a Revia is 3.8 fluid ounces, which is a little larger than Rabbi Willig Shear. It's a lot larger than Rabbi Willig Shear. However, he has a very nice chart over here. I don't think he wrote this, but the organization wrote this nice chart over here. I gave you a big star over there. We noted many above many Shitos, Rabbi Willig being the most lenient, held 2.5 fluid ounces. So half of that would be the 1.25. So he writes over here that as long as you have wine with an alcohol level of 4%, then that would be, you can basically dilute up to that point. And they estimate that that would be about a 1/3 wine with 1/3 water and 1/3 grape juice. Or you can have 1/3 wine and 2/3 water, depending on the strength of your alcohol. And the other option he gives you over here is 1/3 wine, 1/3 grape juice, 1/3 water. So if you do all the math, you can really, if you can dilute, and you could also minimize the amount of the actual shear that you're going to have. Very, very important to buy, we still have time, buy a small cup. Because, as we mentioned, you need to drink the majority of the cup. So if your cup is an 8-ounce cup, which many cups are, you're forcing yourself to drink the 4 ounces when you don't really need to. So best to buy a 3.5-ounce cup. Or even Rabbi Willig would say, buy a, something like that, whatever it is, just enough that your majority of your 2.5 ounces. I guess you would say that you just have to drink rove of the 2.5. So what he would probably tell you is get a 2.5-ounce cup. I don't know how many people could find that, but the way that you can do that, and if you measure ahead of time, which is what ideally what you can do, what you should do is measure with a measuring cup. Because you shouldn't be really measuring on Yom Tov itself. Ideally, if you're not able to and you forget, you can still measure if it's a health risk, if it's important. So that's what you should really do. You should use the 2.5-ounce cup. You should dilute about, I would say, depending on if you're using wine or grape juice, you could dilute up to about a third. And your basic input of sugar and carbohydrates, which is something that someone who should be careful about, that just look, seeing how many carbohydrates and how much sugar is there and how much alcohol level. If you look at all the numbers, it's very very doable. I don't think that it's very difficult. And go over this with the doctor. I should have said at the outset, all these things are very important to go over with a doctor. I would just add, sometimes doctors don't really understand what you're asking. I remember when I was asking a doctor about my wife, it was about fasting Yom Kippur or something like that. And they said, if it's a holiday, you don't want to have to go to the hospital on a holiday, They don't really understand, a holiday doesn't mean, it's a walk in the park, we enjoy, they just don't understand. So sometimes you have to ask a from doctor, because they understand, what you're asking. But either way, anyone who has, don't take my word. Ask a doctor. But what my understanding is that anyone who has an allergy or a sensitivity, this is a very minimum amount that one may be able to be fulfill their mitzvah totally 100% lechadchila for their, as we mentioned, for their situation. Person has a unique situation, and this is exactly what Hashem wants from you. And this is what Rabbi Willig said to do. Okay, let's do a few minutes on kitnios. I have here this whole chart over here. If you want it, I can send it to you separately afterwards. Because it is very helpful, and they talk about how much you should drink and how much dilution and all of that with, very thoroughly. But bear in mind, if you want to use a smaller shear, Rabbi Willig's shear of 2.5 ounces, you should you'd have to do the math, recalculate. That's the word. Okay. So the last thing I want to discuss is kitnios. So this tshuva was written during the beginning, March 2020, by Rav Hirschel Schechter. It was one of the first Piskei Corona. Rav Schechter wrote many, many tshuvas about how people should follow halacha during COVID and during quarantine, during different times. And I what he says over here is really relevant in general. Somebody who has Crohn's disease, that's the question here, has to drink enriched milk that contains kitnios. So number one, must he wait 6 hours after eating meat? So he always has to keep drinking this. And it would be dangerous for him if he doesn't drink this. And Rav Schechter says, you can certainly not have, you don't have to wait the full 6 hours. You can wait 1 hour, he writes. In addition, if it has to be supplemented with kitnios, Rav Schechter writes, you can drink that on Pesach, even if you're Ashkenazic, even if you are someone who generally does not have kitnios, which is a binding halacha, even though it's a minhag, but it became... the custom has become accepted by the community. But even someone who is of that community, of the Ashkenazic community, may use this this drink if they have Crohn's disease. This milk, which is tempered contains some level of legume or kitnios in it. The reason for that is because the minhag, the accepted practice of not having kitnios, was not applicable to people who are sick, and therefore, someone who needs this for their health. It's not a violation of the minhag. The minhag was never said in such a case. The practice was never. There are many areas where we can see this in halacha that minhagim are usually not. They're not issues. They're non-issues really for someone who is sick. Certainly, someone who is a child who is not able to. Who it would be dangerous for their health may have kitnios. So I just thought that would be important to note. And one last point, how sick you have to be. Rav Schechter writes here, even someone who's a chula she'ein bo sakana, certainly if it would be dangerous, certainly if a person would go to the hospital if they weren't to have this medication that has kitnios in it or whatever it would be, certainly they can take it. But even if it's not going to send them to the hospital, but they will get sick, it's not dangerous, but they're going to get sick, they can certainly take this medication, whatever it may be, even though they're consuming it, even though they're eating it, even though it's going in their mouth, and they're, they may say, I never have kitnios, I never have things with legumes in them. It's totally 100% okay in that situation. That's all I have for now. Open to fielding any questions. Hopefully, if I don't have the answers, I can look them up. But if anyone has any questions, now is a chance.